Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello!
Hello! Happy birthday for this week.
Thank you. I actually had a lovely day. My wife, for a surprise, rented a little motorboat and we went puttering up and down the canal in central London.
I didn't have you as a motorboat driver. Were you in the sort of driver's seat?
I was, yeah. I used to have a boat, actually. When I used to spend a lot of time in Sweden, I used to have a little motorboat.
It was a yacht. It was a yacht.
But it was a super yacht, yes.
You were an oligarch with a yacht. That's where the Jeffocracy came from, basically.
Do you remember the Duran Duran video, Rio?
Nah.
Hang on, you're a man of the 80s. You don't remember their famous video on the yacht?
Well, I remember the song, Rio, but I mean... Okay. I was pretty sort of square. I just, you know, I'm not sure.
Square for Duran Duran.
Well, I don't know.
What about Howard's Way?
Yeah, I'm more Howard's Way than Duran Duran.
My boat was neither a super yacht or even a modest yacht. It was just a little, I mean, it basically had an engine the size of a lawnmower engine on the back of it. And I used to go pottering around in the Stockholm archipelago. And I always say to my wife how much I miss it. So we went on the Grand Union Canal from Paddington to Camden.
Did you have to do the locks then? No locks.
There's no locks. If you go for a longer trip, then you have to navigate locks.
Ah.
Which famously are ruinous for a marriage.
What do you mean famously?
Because I think if you go on a narrow boating holiday, I think you see a lot of couples arguing at the locks.
Is that true?
Yeah, I think they're thought of as real triggers for underlying marital issues.
I've got this theory that sat navs have probably lowered the divorce rate. Because don't you think that, I mean, this is slightly simplistic, but I mean, don't you think that like map arguments about maps, you know?
Yes, it's lessened considerably.
My mother had a very good sense of direction, and my father had no sense of direction. and I've inherited my father's. Well, have you got a good sense of direction? I think you probably do.
No, I'm quite a good map reader, but I don't have a good sense of direction. That was the great thing about the canal, though. Really, I didn't have to worry about directions.
Well, that's good.
Just go one way and then come back again.
Yeah,
I was slightly alarmed when we rented the boat. The guy said to me, "Now, occasionally, a carrier bag will get tangled up in the propeller. Here's what you have to
do."
Oh
God! Oh God! Just, oh God!
I went into a panic at that stage because I don't want to be dealing with fishing carrier bags off propellers and using sticks and navigating the boat. Oh, and then something else happened. We came out of a tunnel, or we're coming out of a tunnel, and we see a walking stick drop down from above.
Oh my God! And you rescued it. You are a hero, Jeff. You're amazing. On your birthday, you should definitely get in the local newspaper.
Yeah, well, the people were standing.
Have a go, walking stick hero. Jeff rescues the walking stick.
I think you've correctly intuited what happened because the people were standing above on the bridge saying, "Oh, can you get that walking stick for us?" And I tried to get the boat near it and failed quite miserably and then just had to mouth, "I'm so sorry" to them. This reminded me of, have you ever been in the park and there is a game of football going on a couple of hundred metres away and the ball goes out of play and then it rolls past your feet? And it was the same thing. Yeah. It was beyond my capabilities to get that walking stick back to them.
I mean, funnily, it's funny you should mention this because I don't think we've talked about this. I helped launch Sadiq's Manifesto a couple of weeks back in London, and we went to, like, it was Easter holidays, and we went to a great sort of play scheme. I mean, it definitely had potential, think of it sort of proportions, because there were lots of balls around, including a sort of basketball. So, you know, the person, somebody who works for me, was there with me, and I think she spent quite a lot of the time being quite worried that there was going to be some bad some bad things were going to happen. And they weren't going to happen to Sadiq, put it that way.
You wouldn't have been able to suppress that like you did the trampolining video.
And there were lots of photographers. And fortunately, there was a very low basketball net. So it was sort of quite difficult for me not to get it in. But then there was one moment when Sadiq threw it from in front of him over his head and actually went into the net. And I did think it's going to probably hit me on the head. In a kind of comedy moment, as it sort of hits me on the head, I kind of do a sort of, you know, like a cartoon sort of seeing stars, and then people get a sort of photograph of it, but it didn't happen. There was actually quite, even if I say so myself, there was quite a nice photograph of me and Sadiq as he got the ball in the net. But, you know, definitely brings back memories.
Can I tempt you with a little jaunt up the canal on a motorboat?
I mean, I don't think you'd want me driving.
I can see you. I don't know if it's just because of the jumper you're wearing today. As a gondolier in Venice, you're wearing a stripy jumper, but I think you'd look great in a gondolier. A little neckerchief, singing some light opera to courting couples.
Not sure you want me singing, really.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
I do very much so, having heard you sing.
Well, that's pretty sort of... It's pretty direct.
No, what I mean by that is I think it's a very unique experience and it might take the courting couples out of their moment of romance. They'd be so transfixed by your voice, they'd no longer be able to enjoy the sights and sounds of Venice or Little Venice.
I feel I'm being humiliated.
I would say more condescended to, patronised, yeah.
Right, okay, well, at least there's clarity.
Yeah, let's move on, yeah.
Enough of me being insulted. Yeah. Now, this week of all weeks, I think, is a good week to be talking about the environment and climate. I mean, any week is a good week, but this is the week when we had the Biden Climate Summit, a significant US pledge in relation to global emissions. This week, we're joining up the dots on some of the themes we've explored in the past about how we can both tackle the environmental crisis and build a fairer society in the process. We're talking to two friends of the pod, Matt Lawrence and Laurie Laybourne-Langton, who have written a great new book called Planet on Fire, A Manifesto for the Age of Environmental Breakdown. They argue that as we take steps to address what they call environmental breakdown, we should simultaneously transform our economy. Now, Matt and Laurie propose a whole range of ideas to do that, from an ambitious Green New Deal, and we'll be asking them what that means, to using measures of success beyond GDP alone. It's a fascinating book, and we have a really interesting conversation about their ideas and how to make them a reality. And then we're talking to Dominique Palmer, a young climate justice activist, about how campaigners are building support for the kind of ambition that Matt and Laurie's book calls for.
And our cheerful person is art teacher and winner of the Global Teacher Prize, Andrea Zafirakou. And we're going to be asking Andrea about what it was like to win that prize and then chatting about her new book, Those Who Can Teach.
And also we'll be talking to her about my artwork quite extensively.
What's your reason to be cheerful?
Well, my reason to be cheerful is water-related as well, and I make no apologies, Jeff, as politicians would sort of say, Boris Johnson particularly. I make no apologies for returning to the theme of the water, because, you know, cold water swimming is becoming warmer, and that is a significant reason to be cheerful in the sense of the water is warming up as a result of spring being here. We got to double figures today, 10.5 degrees. Ugh. And you know what? As a sort of, this shows my scientific background, 10.5 degrees turns out to be significantly warmer than 4.5 degrees. Shrinkage is less of an issue. And generally, you know, it's just less cold. So anyway, I'm cheerful about that. What's your reason to be cheerful? I know you're waiting for me to ask.
My wife bought me a shirt for my birthday.
Is that the one you're wearing?
It's not the one I'm wearing, actually. It's and the reason I mention this is because it's made from a fabric that I have never owned clothing made from in my adult life. I think it's wonderful, and I think I want to transition to wearing this fabric most of the time.
What is the fabric?
Terry toweling.
You will have worn them maybe when you were a baby as a nappy.
Yes. Yes, but...
So you're wrong.
Yeah.
So you basically misled our listeners.
No, that's why now. I specifically said as an adult.
Ah.
Yeah. Now, I think maybe the occasional dressing gown could be terry toweling, but it's a shirt. It's the sort of shirt you might wear to a poolside
Can
party.
I have a look? Can you bring it? Can you come on? You've got to bring it.
I tell you where it'd look great if I came to your park.
No, can you not show me? Can you not? Because you're not wearing it.
It's down, so I can go get it if you like.
Yeah, I think so. I think it deserves the thing. Listeners, I'll sort of keep talking about the how interested I am in this. I think it's quite important. Jeff's sort of not at the microphone. I think it's quite important for me to show interest in the birthday present that his wife bought him. I mean, you know, I'm only mildly interested in his terry toweling shirt, but you know, he will get offended if I don't say I'm interested, so I will keep saying how interested I am. I think he will appreciate me saying I'd really like to see it, and I think if I hadn't said I'd really like to see it, then he would probably have said, you're just not interested in my birthday present that my wife bought me. And he might have told his wife that he wasn't interested, and then she would have got offended.
I'm going to do the big see, and he's now. I'm stepping back in front of the webcam.
And he's now back, you see. Oh, my God!
What do you think?
I mean, it is extraordinary, because you wouldn't have thought it was made of terry toweling.
Yeah, look at that. You've got to hold it up to the webcam.
I mean, it sort of basically looks like it's kind of a leftover piece of the costume department from Happy Days.
Don't you think? Could you not just imagine me as a real fun guy at a poolside party?
Don't you think it's quite Happy Days?
Yeah, a little bit, I guess.
It hasn't jumped the shark, but it is definitely Happy
it's
Days.
It's slightly reminiscent of a deck chair. Also, I think it looks like maybe something Kramer might wear in Seinfeld.
Oh, yes, maybe that's what I'm thinking of. Because, and what's clever about it is it's sort of your colour. I think you should post a picture of it. It might become a meme. I think it's your colour because it's got the brown, the autumnal brown. In it, but you know what's clever about it is you'd never have known it was terry toweling from this Zoom.
No, but this is going to be very absorbent.
Do you think that's important?
With me, it definitely is.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, here to talk about their new book, Planet on Fire: A Manifesto for the Age of Environmental Breakdown. We're joined by, I think it's safe to say, friends of the pod. We have Director of the Commonwealth Think Tank, Matt Lawrence, and Laurie Leybourne-Langton, Associate Fellow at the IPPR. Hello, both.
Hello.
Hi, guys. Good to see you.
Congratulations on the book. Have you seen it out in the wild yet?
The other day, I went into Waterstones over at Piccadilly and asked them where it was. And in the end, after walking around the whole shop, we found it on the bottom shelf in the corner under environmental politics. And I bought that one copy. So, yes.
You shouldn't have bought it. You should have moved it to the front. Well, congratulations. And I wondered if maybe Laurie, you can start by explaining... What you mean by environmental breakdown? Because this goes beyond just the climate crisis alone.
Exactly. And in this, we wanted to make a key point around language. Often climate change is the phrase that's used, and there are problems with both of the words in that phrase. On the climate side, as you're alluding to, that doesn't describe the full picture of the assault on the natural world. Species are being made extinct, parts of whole ecosystems and habitats are being torn down, seas are being polluted. So we need to think of it as sort of a wider environmental problem. And then change is too benign. So all of that is an incredibly destructive process. And we're seeing changes in the natural world that are unprecedented, definitely in human history, but also on a longer timescale. And that's why we think environmental breakdown is a much better way to put it. And that requires really a shift in people's minds into an emergency footing when they come to thinking about this, in the same way that we're tragically used to thinking, for example, in terms of the coronavirus pandemic.
Now to explain how we got here, you tell the story of Easter Island, and you tell that story in a different way to what people might have typically heard it. Do you want to tell us that and about the lessons it offers for us?
The classic story of Easter Island, the classical one that's been told for a number of years now, particularly in some environmental communities, is that this island right out there, isolated from anywhere else in the Pacific, had an indigenous population that overused their resources. And they did that unthinkingly. There wasn't anything particularly extraordinary about the people on the island. They did it because they needed to cut down trees to build homes, and they farmed and fished to feed themselves and their kids. And as time went on, they destroyed the environment to such a point that it was no longer able to provide them with the stable, benign conditions that they needed to live. And the critical lessons that this story has to tell for us, we're told by that version of the story, is that humans are short-termist. They have got addicted to certain technologies, in their case, over-exploiting the trees and other bits of the island. And all of that together explains why we're in the same situation we're in now. The planet's like a mini version of Easter Island, a planet scale version of Easter Island. The problem is with that story is it's not true. And really what led to the civilization on Easter Island to collapse was that Westerners arrived and brought with them diseases, and they took many of the people off the island to be sold into slavery. And they killed many of them, often for target practice from boats that were going past. And they weren't doing that for a laugh, those people that came to that island. They were doing it because they were compelled there by increasingly globalized economic systems that demanded people find cheaper nature to exploit and human beings to exploit as well. And so we say in the book that truer story is a much more useful story to have in your mind when you want to understand why it's come to this. But also the fact that we talk about the former one and not the latter one is itself a bit of a story for our blind spots and how we've got into a bind with regards to the environmental crisis that we find ourselves in now.
So, I mean, this week in particular, there have been a lot of announcements on both sides of the Atlantic in terms of tackling the climate crisis. But you say that even this growing action that we're seeing on global emissions, it's insufficient. Why is that?
There are a couple of ways to look at this. We're coming up with lots of targets, which is really good, though it's a bit late in the game, really, for how perilous the situation we find ourselves in. Delivering those targets will not deliver themselves. So delivering on those targets is the key bit that we need to be thinking about. And we're yet at the point where we really have a credible set of policies and ideas from many governments for how that's delivered upon. And secondly, our way of looking at this and you may have seen the graphs, the sort of vertiginous downward line that gets us to zero or net zero in the jargon emissions towards the mid part of the century. A lot of that, or a large part of that, is based upon the idea that we will roll out technologies that will suck emissions down out of the atmosphere on a vast scale. Now, that is going to have to happen. And if we'd started on this more concertedly many decades ago, around the time that I was born at the end of the 1980s, then we may not have had to fall back on that kind of technology. And there's a huge complexities about what that means. But one of the things that's important for your question is that we have to reduce emissions as quickly as possible, as soon as possible, because every bit not only limits the temperature rise or the potential destruction later, but it means that we don't have to fall back on this massive bet of carbon sucking technologies being rolled out by, you know, me in 20 years time and by my kids, you know.
So, Matt, do you want to talk about what you call the three regressive responses to environmental breakdown that you discuss in the book and what the alternative is?
They're three and they sort of overlap almost in a Venn diagram. There's almost like a status quo approach. And we've seen some of those responses this week, which some of it is, you know, top level encouraging. But when you dig beneath the surface, there's still not enough investment. There's still not enough urgency. There's still enough sort of drive to look at sort of the structural causes of environmental breakdown. That then links to a sort of a second response, which would be outright denial, obfuscation. And, you know, we can see that in some of the sort of, you know, populist rights of, you know, Farage's argument saying, oh, well, why on earth do we need to do this? This is, you know, this is just imposing too much cost. Is this even a serious problem? And, you know, someone like Trump in some ways embodied that unwillingness to try and change at all. And then there's a sort of third, sort of very quickly bubbling up. And you can see that in some of the politics of someone like Le Pen's party in France, some of the rhetoric coming out of that, which is this kind of eco-fascist politics, eco-fascist response to the crisis, which says in a world of, you know, rising sea levels, in a world of millions of people displaced by environmental breakdown, the response is not sort of one of equity, one of justice, one of trying to sort of build a better world together. It's about even further, even greater attempts to sort of create borders, to, you know, put even more restrictions on people who have been forced to migrate, a whole set of very violent sort of measures, essentially, that tap into the destabilisation of environmental breakdown and then politicise that in a really reactionary sort of eco-fascist response. And so, you know, in terms of our response, well, what we say is, like, the good news, but also the bad news, is that we say that in some ways environmental breakdown in the round is overwhelmingly a political crisis, in the sense that we have the resources, we increasingly have the capability, the technologies, the techniques that we need to begin not just to decarbonize our economies, but to bring us within sustainable limits. So what we say is, you know, to meet that political crisis, what we need is to offer a really big, bold, inclusive, transformative offer of a better world. So not just decarbonising our existing economy, but actually in the process, making that a whole society-wide effort to build a future, a post-carbon future, that is just and democratic by design.
Can I relate this back to what Laurie said about Easter Island? Are you saying this because you want a fairer society? You obviously do. Or are you saying this because it sort of relates to tackling this particular problem?
So I think one of the great strengths is that the things we need to do to build a sustainable world are the things that will actually make life more pleasant, more secure, more flourishing for ordinary people. So let's take, you know, transport. By decarbonising our transport stock, we actually, you know, reduce air pollution. We have sort of better flows of traffic. We have much, you know, more walking and cycling and low carbon forms of leisure, which are sort of going to make life more pleasurable. So there is this coincidence that actually doing the things we want will build sort of a better and a fairer world, exactly because this is about healthier communities. It's about better forms of work. It's about more forms of leisure. It's about more forms of communal luxury, you know, good parks, nice of, you know, local theatres, whatever it might be, that those forms of low carbon but public luxury, those are some of the solutions. And they can actually build a big sort of political boat, so to speak, because those are solutions that actually improve everyone's life, as well as tackling the inequality and climate crisis, which are conjoined.
Let's talk then about some examples of what your approach would look like in practice, and you go through a number of areas in your in the book, starting with sort of GDP, and we've covered this on the podcast before. Say a little bit, if you will, about sort of why and how we need to think beyond GDP.
GDP was a sort of, you know, a metric for measuring our economy, which was invented in sort of, you know, 20s and 30s. And, you know, like many of the institutions that organised our economy in the 20th century, they potentially had their place, but their relevance to how we measure the good life, how we measure how an economy serves human needs, which is ultimately what, you know, economies should be for, not humans serving economic needs, is increasingly less clear. And, you know, I'm sure in your previous podcast you'd have sort of, you know, explored some of the ways that GDP as sort of metrics of success fails to sort of get at the things that we all really value, whether it's clean air, you know, quality time with their family, whatever it might be. So we say, like, yes, like, we should have metrics, but they should be more expansive. It should be about how we can expand leisure time, how we can expand sustainability, how can we can expand sort of inclusivity in what we do grow. And actually the focus should exactly be on thriving relationships, thriving communities, well-being. And that, you know, that may be coincident with sort of GDP in a traditional sense, but we think actually we need to be much more ambitious in terms of the measures we use in the 21st century to work out what we value.
You also talk about something called universal basic services in your book that's different from universal basic income. It is also something we've covered some podcasts ago. Say a little bit about that and its relevance here.
Universal basic services is the collective democratic provision of the assets and institutions and services we need to live well. So whether that might be broadband, whether that might be sort of transport systems, whether that might be housing, there are a series of things that all of us need. And then actually, if we think about it, just planning and delivering those services so that everyone can have access, everyone can enjoy this, is actually much more efficient, equitable, and also sort of lower carbon way of organising society. Because if you just think about it, you know, people travelling on a bus, and a decarbonised sort of, you know, free bus, let's say, will just have less environmental impacts than all those same people driving a car. But so that idea of universal basic services is about sort of how can we collectively organise our society so that individuals can thrive, but also that all of us have access to the means to live a good life.
As I read your book, you know, you go through the way that firms need to change, the way that the financial system needs to change, as well as the way, as Matt's talked about, that we need to think about, you know, things like GDP or universal basic services. I mean, what would you say to those people who say, look, chaps, you know, you've got this massive challenge, which is the climate emergency, and you're adding to that, you know, the transformation of capitalism, which has proved, to put it mildly, slightly tricky. You know, you presumably would say, well, it's just necessary to transform the model of capitalism fundamentally if you're going to solve the climate crisis.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the key things that makes it not just more imaginable and real for people, but I think more politically possible, is when we tie together the disenfranchisement and suffering that's come as a result of other parts of our economic system, when we connect those to the environmental crisis, which is we are absolutely able to do, what it does is provide it gets it back to the root cause of the problem here. And it also makes it more politically alive. And I think that's one of the amazing things that's happened, particularly in recent years, is that it's connected with other problems that people are having, because that connection absolutely exists. And the solutions that could deal with both simultaneously are there now.
And in the book, you do emphasise the importance of political strategy. You know, because it's quite comprehensive vision, you know, one thing you might think is, well, where the hell do we start with this? You know, how are you going to go about it? You must have thought a lot about that and talked a lot about that as you were writing the book. So why don't you say something about that?
But that's in some ways the key question. You know, you can come up with cookbooks of the future, but unless you actually, you know, make the meal, ultimately it becomes a little redundant. That again goes back to this point I made earlier about the political crisis, in that sort of, you know, the tension is that, you know, we increasingly know what needs to be done, and yet we can't mobilise the political power to do it. So what we do in the book is, as you say, we sort of sketch some potential strategies, and we sort of dig into one, you know, relatively recent example in which there has been a really significant paradigmatic shift in how our economy was organised, which is, of course, sort of, you know, the Thatcherite revolution in the late 70s and early 80s. And there are obviously very important differences, but some similarities that we can perhaps draw on. There was a big crisis in the 70s, a sort of long-running crisis that neither the left or the right seemed to be able to resolve. And then what happened was in the late 70s, this is a very quick historical review, but then, the, you know, in the late 70s, there was this sort of breakthrough from what was considered at the time a very radical solution. And if we sort of unpick some of those themes, there was a building up of sort of, you know, popular coalitions because there was real material gains given to people. So right to buy and privatization gave people real benefits. There was also prefiguration. So what didn't just come out of nowhere, things like right to buy were trialled in places like Wandsworth. And then there's also this sort of ecosystem of ideas, of voices in the media, of influential business people that kind of laid the ground and helped support this transformation. So what does that look like now in terms of strategy? Well, that suggests we need to prefigure. So we need to sort of scale up publicly owned electric vehicle, you know, transport networks in Greater Manchester, for example, or publicly owned energy companies or green cooperatives, or really support B corporations or businesses like Unilever that are trying to sort of decarbonize and show the future today. We need to think about, you know, strategically coordinating, you know, social movements, think tanks, all those type of things. We need to build up sort of, you know, a new sort of story that links together decarbonisation with a story of national renewal. And that's for something like a Green New Deal, about a whole society-wide effort to build out a sort of future of post-carbon plenty through a sort of national effort and sort of, you know, linking that towards global solidarity as well. You know, that's about the story. Many of the seeds of the type of things we need to talk about, whether it's, you know, the scaling of community-owned renewable energy, sort of green forms of financing, sort of trade unions that are increasingly like really sort of focusing in on what are the sort of types of just transition, whether it's sort of, you know, social movements that are combining racial justice with climate justice with global solidarity. Many of these things are already here, and it's just a question of cohering them and creating that leverage to sort of bring that new world to birth. Because it's not, you know, it's the world is always pregnant with change. It's about how you can then sort of, you know, which sort of trajectory will you go off from that position.
Now Matt, you talked about the idea of a Green New Deal. That phrase is bandied around a lot. Just say to us, what does the phrase mean to you and Laurie, if you can speak for Laurie, and sort of what and what, you know, and what role, you know, what's its importance?
So Green New Deal, whether it's, you know, in the UK, the US or globally, it's about a whole society-wide effort coming together to drive the rapid and just, critically, transformation of our society towards one of post-carbon sort of equity. So it combines climate and economic justice together and puts in place, whether it's green housing, green transport networks, green energy systems, green food systems, the investment, the care, the urgency we need to bring that about.
And talk to us about, if you like, that's the kind of big narrative and kind of big idea in this. Talk to us about the role of local action and in towns and cities as a way of pointing the way towards this kind of agenda, if you like, a sort of bottom-up process.
You think about it, you know, towns and cities are about, you know, where we come together to live in it. You can see how you can begin to organise in towns and cities, whether it's transport systems, new forms of communal leisure, parks, theatres, leisure centres, you know, public and shared institutions, which tend to have lower carbon sort of impacts, lower environmental impacts in the round, versus, you know, much more carbon-intensive private consumption. So I think in towns and cities, we can really see the vanguard of this transformation taking place.
How do we get past thinking about this as a set of policies in waiting for the next social democratic or left-wing government? How do we sell these ideas to people on the right or centre-right who aren't climate sceptics, but they think the wonder and the ingenuity of capitalism is going to solve this? And actually, they would hear these ideas as a Trojan horse for socialism.
Mm. So the first thing I'd say is that it's very important to stress that all parts of society have to be a part in this transition, as you're alluding to. We cannot hope to roll out a vast, what will end up being, multi-generational project to restabilise the natural world if it's seen as a hugely oppositional thing where half the population wants to participate in a certain way and the other half doesn't. Within that, it's important also to remember that what is perceived as left-wing or right-wing or centrist or whatever way you want to look at it, is not immutable. It does change over time. And there are certain things that would have been unimaginable as conceiving as being part of a conservative manifesto of the 1980s at the beginning of the 1970s, for example.
What can our listeners do? What can we kind of ask people or inspire people to go away and do on this?
What can people do? Well, we can begin to build the type of, you know, cross-society power that can create those forms of leverage that can enact change. So that might be, you know, potentially if you're in work, you know, joining a trade union, beginning to work towards sort of just transition plans within your workplace. It could be joining a renters union and sort of saying, insisting, look, we need sort of decarbonised housing stock as well as affordable rent. It could be about sort of, you know, moving your money into, Triodos Bank, or whoever it might be, that invests in sustainable metrics. It could be about joining wider campaigns that sort of begin to put, you know, mobilize collective pressure, because, you know, ultimately this is, you know, this can't be done individually. There's really no shortage of options, which goes back to that, you know, key point. This is a political crisis, but therefore we have a whole range of tools to build that sort of social power to resolve that crisis in the direction of equality, equity and sustainability.
Matt, Laurie, thank you very much.
Lovely to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Now, to talk about some of the practical ways in which this agenda that we've just talked about can be put into practice, I'm delighted to say that we're joined by Dominique Palmer, activist with Fridays for the Future and the UK Student Climate Network. Let's start. What's the story of how you got involved in climate activism?
So for me, this was about 2 years ago. I was still a student. I just finished my A-levels and I started to educate myself more about the climate crisis, and I became more aware of the severity of the climate and ecological emergency. And so I went to my first climate strike and then the following kind of actions that were organised. And once I just found that climate movement, I realised that there was something I could do about the crisis, and that's what really pushed me into action.
What did it feel like attending the climate strike for the first time? You know, was it sort of an eye-opener for you?
Yeah, it was. I mean, for the very first time, it was really nice to see all the people that were out there that felt, you know, just as passionate and just had the same urgency as I did. And to kind of see that and like feel the momentum and like the energy was just incredible. And it really also gave like it put some weight off of my shoulders as well. It felt like I wasn't the only one trying to act on this.
And can you talk to us a bit about why it's so important for everyone, but specifically to you, to have justice at the heart of climate action?
So when it comes to justice, it's mainly because the climate crisis doesn't exist, you know, in a vacuum. It's so interconnected to us and to society. And the crisis right now is really fueled by inequalities and exploitation of people and the planet, and particularly those in the global south. And in a more kind of like personal sense, I grew up in one of the most like polluted areas in London, for example. And this is also something that like across the UK, a lot of communities, particularly black and brown communities, are facing. And so there you can see a lot of the different inequalities when it comes to this like global crisis as well.
Dominique, talk to us just about how you've changed as a result of getting involved in this. I mean, you know, what's been your journey in relation to this whole issue?
I've really found like my individual power and like my voice and that I have. And I've realized that, you know, even as individuals, we have so much more power than we realize to act. And especially when we come together as a collective, that's like incredibly powerful. And I've also gained a lot more confidence in doing that. You know, I was talking to one of my friends about this and they weren't really sure like what difference you could really make. You know, they were like, you know, the system that we're in, you can't make much of a difference or an impact as like one person. And I really just, well, now it's proven wrong that you really can.
Dominique, we've spoken about Fridays for Future on the podcast before, and I wondered if you had any thoughts on what we can learn from being involved in that campaign, what we can learn from that about how to build support for change.
I think one of the key things to learn and that I've learned is the power of the people, and that this has to be understood in order to empower others as well. essentially the people united will never be defeated, and a movement is like created and sustained by just so many people, not just one type of person, not just one type of activist, but so many different people bringing so many different skills. And so behind every strike and protest and action and campaign that we do, there are just so many different people behind this. And having that like grassroots level movement is so important. But the most important thing is that we don't let it fade into just a moment and keep up the momentum, essentially, because that's how we win and that's how we reach other people. And that's how we really show those in power that we won't back down.
And tell us about Climate Live, which is something that you're involved in. What is it? And tell us more about it.
Yeah, so with Climate Live on April 24th, there'll be just really exciting live streamed music events taking place like all over the world, and like different actions that are music related in over 40 countries. And this is all leading up to our concerts in October, our big concert. And then October 16th are our big concert. So there will be like simultaneous global youth-led climate concerts in over 40 countries led by the Fridays for Future youth climate groups.
Well, look, it's been incredibly inspiring to talk to you. The whole climate movement has been supercharged by the voice of young people. We'll look out, and we'd urge our listeners to look out for the events under Climate Live. Dominique Palmer, thank you so much for joining us.
Amazing. Thank you.
Well, what did you think?
I came out of it feeling a bit more optimistic than I did going in, because when I did the reading up on the episode, I felt, well, these are a great ideas, but it felt a long way off when you think about things like the electoral cycle. But I guess I was quite persuaded by the idea that these policies don't need to belong to the left or the right, and especially when you think about that in context of, you know, at the last election, the Conservatives would never have announced the kind of support package we've seen during the pandemic. But the emergency of the pandemic has meant that they introduced the measures that they did. And about actually, if you can get people to think about the environmental breakdown in the right way, then it's not just a future manifesto for a socially democratic or left-wing party. It's ideas that could belong to anyone and everyone because of the urgency of it.
I think that's right. And I'd say two things I take out of it. Look, the first is it's incredibly important that, and I think we can't say this enough, that as we talk about tackling the climate crisis, we don't just talk about avoiding the nightmare, but we talk about better lives for people. Because the language of it, this just being about a big sacrifice that we have to make now, to caricature it slightly, just to make the point, you know, let's have worse lives now because that's important to save the planet, I just don't think is right. It's not because I don't think there's some degree of sacrifice or change involved, but because I think if you cut air pollution, create good jobs, more green spaces, all of which help to contribute to tackling the climate crisis, you'll have better lives for people. And we've got to be about better lives for people. And I think, you know, that for me, that's the most important takeout of Laurie and Matt's book. And the second thing, I think, as you say, is, you know, things can seem impossible until they actually happen. You know what I mean? It's so you might think, well, it all sounds a bit far-fetched, you know, is it ever going to happen, etc. But on the other hand, would we really have said, and I'm not saying that the Biden thing is the complete answer, would we really have said that, you know, a year ago, America will be cutting its emissions by half? Would we really have said there'll be a $1 trillion, you know, infrastructure plan that would be produced? So you know, things look impossible until they're no longer impossible.
Email us reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter @cheerfulpodcast or search for our Facebook page, Reasons to be Cheerful Podcast.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
For our cheerful person this week, we're going to talk to author of Those Who Can Teach, What It Takes to Make the Next Generation. It is the world's best teacher, Andrea Zafirakou. Hello. I can describe you as that, right?
Yeah, you could say 2018. It still feels so strange. Yes, but hello. Hello to you all.
This was the Global Teacher Prize that you won in 2018. So you're not the reigning world's best teacher.
No, gosh, that weight has now been lifted. There's a wonderful young man who represents India who's now the winner. So, yes, so my period was 2018.
And did you have to pass the trophy on?
No, mine is actually in the back. It's standing proud in my on my bookshelf in my office at school. So it's there and it's gleaming and it's got lovely memories. And it's there.
Well, tell us about some of those memories. I mean, how did it happen? You ended up going to Downing Street the day after the award ceremony. Tell us the story.
It was quite a long process. So I was nominated by an ex-colleague of mine and I had no idea about this particular award, never heard of it. And they nominated me and they said, please, can you look out for the email and apply? So I wasn't interested in doing that. And I think on the day before my wedding, the night before my wedding, I had received an email to say, please, can you apply? And then I quickly did it because there was a deadline. And then I went, right, it's done, it's there, it's gone. And the next thing I heard was a few months later, I made it into the top 50. So... and that was plenty. That was enough. You know, top 50 from like 30,000 applications.
Wow.
Across 170 countries. So it's pretty huge. And I think that's when my heart just went a bit like, oh my God, what's happened? What is this? And then a few months later, I found out I was in the top 10. And then I think from then on, my life changed significantly. March the 18th was the day that I found out I was the global Teacher Prize winner, and that was in Dubai. We had a fabulous conference in Dubai. I felt so uncomfortable and out of place. Everywhere you looked was ministers and celebrities, and then there was these little teachers just huddling together, thinking we are so out of place. And then the days after winning and having that crazy, wild, fun 24 hours of just interviews and more interviews and chaos and cameras and everything. I didn't sleep on that flight home because first of all, I was in business class. I've never been in business class in my time. So the amount of buttons that was on a Dubai flight, you know, I was like, right, you know. So landed there and then I was told, right, we have to go to Downing Street. Went to Downing Street. So I went to Parliament first. Met and then I was in the gallery for their Prime Minister's question time, and that was pretty cool because the Prime Minister at that time, Theresa May, said, and we're so proud that we have, you know, the best teacher in the world as a UK teacher, and everybody was like, rah! and then you had Jeremy Corbyn at the opposition, and that comes up, well, I've actually already met her, and I met her last week. And then there's little old me in the gallery upstairs going, oh my God, they're fighting over me.
Tell us a bit about your approach to teaching and your story. You know, what was it that led this former colleague of yours to nominate you in the first place?
Can you see how, because this is a Zoom call, I've got my hands like this on my head. I'm scratching my head trying to think, why? Why is it? It's because for the last 15 years, I have loved and dedicated my life to my school, loved helping my kids, the students, loved celebrating the arts, working with my colleagues, really trying to raise achievement.
So let me take me for instance. I was not brilliant at art or textiles at school. I bizarrely got an A in my, I'm boasting now, in my O-level, as it then was, that's before GCSEs, art, but I think it was a sort of travesty, really. I mean, I don't think I merited it at all. So if I came into your lesson and I'm a year seven, let's say, so I've just come from primary school, how are you going to engage me?
Yeah, well, the thing is that I'm really sorry that you had an experience whereby you weren't praised or your confidence wasn't tapped into or motivated or acknowledged. I think that's the thing. So my job as an art teacher is to make sure that I find the thing which every child can do to say, oh my God, that's really, you must be really proud of that. Look what you've achieved. And it doesn't have to be drawing. I think the biggest fear which they have is painting. I normally ban rubbers or erasers in my room because I try and get them to kind of get out, you know, to really feel much more in control and master the equipment, take risks. I sometimes get them to draw in pen so that they can't, you know, it's whatever line you're making, you're going to have to, you're going to have to love that line.
And you look horrified by that prospect.
No, but yeah. What it does, it just pushes them out of their comfort zone. And that's when they take risks and that's when they learn. And that's when they have those kind of real breakthrough moments.
You see, one of the reasons, just to go back to me for a second.
Ed, is this about you or about me?
Well, it may be a bit of both. But, you know, the reason I ended up with the A level, sorry to go on about this, is that I did a really basic picture of like a tree in a telephone box, which was around my house. And it's like a long story. I think I have told Jeff before because I hadn't done the coursework. And then eventually I did it all at the last minute and I could only do something very simple. But then it was my teacher who said to me, well, maybe you should think about, you know, like a geometric design. So I did these compass circles and then I colored them in different ways. You know, I think in a way she helped me find something I might be more apt to do, you know what I mean?
Well, do you know what's quite interesting about this conversation? You've more or less memorized that lesson, that moment, what you had to do. And I think that's the beauty about the art room, be it the music room, drama room. It's the lesson, the journey of making that end product, the decisions you've got to make, the challenges you'll face. I think that's the learning that will always be embedded in you.
There are lots of stories of students in your book. Talk to us about Alvaro's story and what it shows about that importance of art, because it's a really important story in the book and what's the wider lesson of it?
So his story is that he transferred to my school from a specialist school, and it was a special educational needs school, and he had loads and loads of labels that you would say attached with him, which were about his learning disability. And one of them was that he was selected mute, so he would not talk. He was absolutely intimidated, and he came to us and he sat in my GCSE art class, and it was my job to get him a grade. And I thought, well, this is not going to be possible. His parents don't think he can achieve. He's just babysitting. He's here for me to babysit. But after that first lesson, I set them the whole class a homework, and he wasn't engaging at all. He was literally just almost like a ghost figure, terrified. And the next lesson, he came in, brought in his homework. Then when I saw what he created, which was this most incredible drawing of a guitar, I just screamed. I was like, stop! Did you make this piece? Is this yours, Alvaro? And he looked at me, and I saw his beautiful eyes for the first time. And then he was like, he was shocked. He was looking around to think, somebody saved me from this mad woman. And I was like, is this your work? And he nodded, and that was it. I was like, right, you can. And so I bombarded him with things and pencils and materials. Like, I want you to do me this, 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 this. And he did. And it was a really difficult journey for him. But he went from having a predicted grade of nothing to getting a D at GCSE. But the game changer was, is that throughout the time at the school, he became so confident. He was carrying around his portfolio in the playground, like, and the kids would come up and talk to him. He'd come and sit at the back of my class when he had a free lesson, and he would sit there quietly. The kids would go up to him and go, what are you doing? What are you doing? Or show me how you do that. Let me have a look at your book. And for him, it was the room, the space that changed his life.
And there's a wider lesson here, isn't there, Andrea, which we were talking just before the microphone went on, because you begin the book by a conversation after the one you had with Theresa May, with Nick Gibb, the schools minister. And, you know, your frustration at the way in which the government has narrowed the focus of schools to the EBAC and downgraded creative subjects. And isn't the Alvaro lesson and the wider lesson of your book that creative subjects like art, textiles and so on are, and I think this is what the government underestimates, are a multiplier. In other words, they're kind of good in themselves, but they can also transform people's educational experience more widely.
Absolutely. I could not agree with you more. I was just speaking to a poet who's a rap artist, and he said to me, because of being a rap artist and the skill needed, I'm better at maths and better at science. It's really made me become more aware of the language terminology. And I just thought, this is what we need to hear. You know, why are you not on a platform? And I'm just thinking, this is exactly right. It's the transformative skills which the arts and the experiences produce. The problem is that you can't measure them, can you? They're not measured, or we don't measure them. And that's why it's we say no, not that they're not worthy, or no, they're not good enough at the moment.
Now, there was prize money, $1 million, and you used that to set up a charity, Artists in Residence.
Yes, I did.
Talk to us about that decision.
It was, how uncomfortable, right? You get $1 million, and how stressful is that, having a label, World's Best Teacher, $1 million?
And just to be clear about this, were there any constraints on how you could use the money?
No, the money is mine.
So you could have bought, like, you know, 10 Ferrari. Lamborghinis.
Yeah, I could have paid off my mortgage. I could have, there's loads of, I could have. But the way I see it, and I'm so comfortable with this decision, is the fact that I do believe that the reason why I'm here is because of the support and everything that's happened in my school. And a school is bigger than one person, you know, it's my community. I decided to set up a charity foundation called Artists in Residence because I wanted schools in deprived areas and the students there to really experience and get that joy, that wow moment of being connected with the real role model, with the real artist. And working with artists, there's something magical that happens there. The kids' eyes light up. It's the outcomes is incredible. The teachers learn from that experience. So what we do, we just bring artists into schools to collaborate and produce a bespoke project which the whole school community can celebrate.
Andrea Zafirakou, art and textiles teacher, the world's best teacher, and author of the book Those Who Can Teach: What It Takes to Make the Next Generation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, we're in the outro.
We are. I need to tell you about a disturbing comment.
Gone.
On last week's promo video.
Yeah.
Somebody commented that I look like Mike Harding.
You know what? That's really accurate.
The Rochdale Cowboy.
Is that what he's known as?
I believe that's what they called him. I mean, I'm a well-wisher towards Mike Harding. I've enjoyed some of his output. I'm not sure that was the look I was going for.
I mean, actually, you texted me to say this, and I thought it was quite uncanny, actually.
This isn't good. I was hoping you'd say, Jeff, no, it's not that type of moustache. It's more kind of an East London hip moustache, not a ageing folk singer.
Jeff, it's not that type of moustache. It's more an East London kind of hip moustache.
The insincerity.
Well, I am a politician. Right. Shall we thank our guests? I'd like to thank Matt Lawrence and Laurie Laybourne-Langton. And I'd like to thank Dominique Palmer.
And thanks to the brilliant Andrea Zafirakou for cheering us all up and telling us about her book. Emma Caution produces our podcast, all the research and guests found by Joel Pearce. He shows his working out on our website. You can go and look at that, cheerfulpodcast.com.
Joel, go to our website.
Go to it.
We love our website. You love our website. Everybody loves our website.
What a destination for you to go
to. Honestly, you are missing out if you are not on our website.
Absolutely. There we go. I think that was hard enough sell, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Go to our website.
And Joel is backed up in this by Joe Kenyon. We also say hello to our friends at
left foot forward. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer.
By the way, I was driving through Leeds and we were in a taxi. Who should I hear on the radio? And I said, that's Gail Lofthouse. And the guy said to me, yeah, that is Gail Lofthouse.
Yes, Gail, our announcer, who has been nominated for, I believe, a very prestigious radio award.
Has she?
Yes.
We love Gail.
We do.
Almost as much as we love our website.
I don't think that's great saying that we love a website.
No, we love Gail more than our website. Okay, yeah. Okay. We love our website almost as much as Gail. Yeah.
Yes. Ed Seed composed the music, James Deacon made our idents, and our artwork was designed by
Henry Cole. He's been Captain Jeff.
He's been Cabin Boy Ed.
And these have been
Reasons to be Nautical.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.